Mass incarceration has emerged as a far more extreme form of physical and residential segregation than Jim Crow segregation. Rather than merely shunting people of color to the other side of town, people are locked in literal cages en masse. Those are the words of Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Why does America lock up a higher proportion of its population than any other country on earth? And how does racism play a role in who ends up behind bars? Are there different patterns of incarceration in big cities versus rural areas? Joining me to talk about mass incarceration and race is Pamela Oliver, UW Professor Emerita of Sociology. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm interested always in what leads people to study a certain topic over their professional career. And what led you to being interested in studying mass incarceration and various patterns, including the pattern of race?
So I really came at this from the community end. My professional expertise is in collective action and social movements, but I'm also a human being. And I was looking for a way to reengage the community after my children got older. I'd sort of stepped out for a while. And I went off to a meeting put on by other people. I had nothing to do with doing it. I was just in the audience on called Money, Education, and Prisons, about how the problem is money was being sucked into prisons and away from education. I learned a lot at that conference. There was a group formed actually under the aegis of Madison Area Urban Ministry to continue discussing these issues in the community. And so I volunteered as a human being to be on that committee. And because I had sociological skills, I thought people would be interested in, like, well, who's in prison? Why are they in prison? And because I have these skills, I could get a hold of some data and start looking at some data on these patterns. And when I started looking at it, I was really shocked, discovering these massive disparities in Wisconsin's incarceration rate. And I just started getting involved in it from there. It's sort of a combination. It's always been primarily public, what we call public sociology, giving lectures and talks about the trends with an emphasis on Wisconsin. But then also doing kind of more sociological analysis of comparisons across states and places. I'm not trained as a criminologist, and I feel like even 20 years later, I'm still kind of playing catch up as a criminologist in some ways. But over time, I've learned a lot about the data patterns and also spent a lot of time on boards and commissions, and so interacting with people in the system and really learning a lot about the system.
And you served on the Governor's Commission to reduce racial disparities in criminal justice,
right? I did,
indeed.
And also the Dane County Task Force on the same topic.
And it is shocking to look at Wisconsin's record as the worst state in the country in terms of locking up black men. But before we get to Wisconsin in particular, can you talk about the United States and incarceration? Because I've seen a graph in one of the talks you've given that put the USA at this top of the list of all the countries in the world.
Yeah, it was in about, I think it was in the 90s that the United States passed Russia. Before that, Russia had had the highest incarceration rate. And so, yeah, the United States has managed to top all of the world's nations in its incarceration rate. The trend went up. I haven't actually seen what the comparative rates looked like in the 1960s, so I can't speak to that. But I do know that United States incarceration rate was pretty relatively stable for much of the 20th century. And then in the 1970s began to go up and increase steadily, almost exponentially for a while. So that's, I guess the other thing I can say, as I often say as part of my introduction, is even if you pull out like United States non-Hispanic white incarceration rate is actually very high by world standards. Our white non-Hispanic incarceration rate is 3 or 4 times higher than the European incarceration rate. But then our black incarceration rate is a lot higher than our white incarceration rate. And so by international standards, the black incarceration rate is just enormous. It has few parallels anywhere in the world.
I'm looking at a graph, which obviously can't see on the radio, but, you know, you've got America at the top there for imprisonment rate. And under that is El Salvador, Turkmenistan, Thailand, Cuba, Rwanda, Russia, and so on. And there's, you know, it skips down quite a while until you get to another country that you might expect to have, you know, like United Kingdom or something. So we're
very, very high. Very,
yeah.
Very high.
So let's look at why. Why do you think that is? I mean, is it that we have more people who deserve to be locked up, or is it that our standards are different, or that we have so many people who are repeat offenders? What is it?
Well, so I don't actually know the answer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, guess.
Well, I can tell you some of the things it's not. The United States crime rate is middling. It's neither exceptionally high nor exceptionally low. So you could either say, oh, the really low crime rate maybe is related to high incarceration, or the really high crime rate might be related to incarceration, but neither is true. The crime rate in the United States is very middling. Why we incarcerate more – I mean, at one level, it's, well, we incarcerate more people because more people are sentenced to prison. They have longer sentences. We have higher rates of revocation. So those are the mechanical things that are producing this high rate. There's actually a lot of debate about why at some level. I think there's common agreement that it was a series of policy decisions to raise incarceration, and those policy decisions were primarily political and, I think, racial. Exactly how race worked, people disagree about. But in general, at the end of the 1960s, ordinary crime was actually at pretty high rates. But also there'd been the urban riots and also the student protests, and so there'd been a lot of social turmoil. The survey questions at the time actually linked protest and crime into one question. And so you could tell that discursively protest and crime were being combined as, you know, crime in the streets rhetoric was being combined.
So you mean, for example, if somebody belonged to a group like the Black Panthers or some other social group, that was put on a par with committing a crime?
It was more like so in this era, there had been the Black urban riots as well as the student protests and riots. People were asked questions about do you think there's been, you know, too much disorder and crime, sort of combining mm-hmm. them. So in that way, the questions weren't specifically about Black Panthers, but they were about your perception that there'd been a lot of disruption and turmoil.
Sort of the law and order.
Yeah, so
idea,
law and
right?
order was combining both. Mm-hmm. The phrase law and order was definitely addressing both issues. There's a lot of research from the 1970s about how so the Law Enforcement Assistance Act was passed in the 60s, a lot more police, a lot more money going into policing, a lot of emphasis on riot control and crime control, and basically studies saying that the surveillance and activities that were originally directed against left-wing and minority protest movements then became directed against crime more generally. And so the whole way you started doing policing was basically doing both in combination. That's kind of the 70s. Incarceration rates rose in the 1970s. There's not really good data on race from the 70s, but I've looked at it pretty closely, the spotty data, and I can't find even one state that had a consistent rise in the racial disparity in incarceration in the 1970s. Incarceration generally was going up, but not the disparity. The rise in the disparity is actually happening in the 1980s, especially in the late 80s, but throughout the 80s. And that's happening in the Reagan-Bush era. And that's in an era where, especially as the decade wears on, you start having this more racialized anti-drug discourse. And I know for sure that most of the rise in Black incarceration and the rise – so incarceration generally is rising, but then in the 80s you see this it's when the disparity really goes up. And that's almost entirely the drug war. And that's if you had not had the increase in the disparity in black drug sentences, you would still have a disparity because it's a longstanding disparity, but the disparity would not have gone up. You just would have seen incarceration generally rising, but not the disparity.
And was that mostly with heroin or with crack cocaine? Or
It was specifically the crack epidemic, what's called the crack epidemic. So there definitely was a problem. It started in New York and Los Angeles. There was a lot of debate at the time about what was going on. It started with an anti-marijuana campaign, actually, and so there were some arguments that part of what gave crack an opening in the 1980s was that the price of marijuana went up, and if you were going to pay more, you might as well get more bang for the buck, essentially. But whatever happened, crack started being sold, and then there came to be this panic discourse, we call it, where even though crack use was already declining, people started passing these draconian penalties for crack specifically. So whites actually used and use illegal drugs at about the same rates as blacks do. Whites, however, were primarily using powder cocaine, and crack cocaine was more specifically being sold in black areas. And even though – so the rates of use of crack cocaine were actually higher for blacks than for whites. But because there's more whites than blacks, there were actually more white crack cocaine users than black crack cocaine users. Despite that, like, there's been studies that over 90% of the images of a crack user were black. So it was a highly racialized discourse about it. And you just see in the statistics, you can just see this massive increase in black drug sentences practically everywhere, beginning in 1987 and going through into the 1990s.
So that if you had a white powder cocaine user, they would be less likely to be sentenced to prison?
Well, so I don't have that level of detail in the data because which drug it was is usually not well recorded. And even the which drug would lump together crack and powder cocaine, it doesn't tell them apart. What did happen is that the mandatory minimums for crack were much more draconian. So very small amounts of crack cocaine were drawing mandatory minimum sentences. It was basically you were presumed to be a dealer if you had more than 5 grams of crack cocaine. And there was not a comparable level of presumption of being a dealer if you had powder cocaine. So that's what was happening. I think a lot of the difference, first of all, white drug sentences also went up in that era. It's just that black drug sentences went up faster. Most of it was where people were policing is actually what was happening. So that arrests for drug sentences, arrests for drugs correlated with prosecutions for drugs, correlated with sentences for drugs. And it was the choices about where to police. So it's in the you start putting your enforcement efforts in black communities, you will find black drug dealers. If you put your enforcement in white communities, you'll find white drug dealers. But the enforcement was really being targeted in black areas.
In the book, Locking Up Our Own, by James Forman Jr., that won the Pulitzer Prize last year, he talks about how there was a lot of pressure to get the drug dealers off the streets do something to make the black communities safer. And so that some of the efforts to crack down on users and dealers came from within the black community.
Oh, that's definitely true. That is definitely true. As a white person, I tend to indict white society, but there's no question that it's hard to get a right balance in talking about it because I do think all of this incarceration was unjust and ultimately counterproductive. At the same time, it is true that there were devastating consequences of drug addiction and drug dealing that were mostly impacting black communities. And it's absolutely true that black politicians and black activists were often part of who was calling for a crackdown and more punitive responses. As one little tidbit, I actually took a look at black mayors and black drug incarcerations typically increased during the period of black mayors in Los Angeles and New York and a few other places. They did not decrease. So that's certainly part of the politics of what was going on, that there really was a problem in the community. And there is a tendency for people to I think wrongly, but there's a tendency for punitive responses to problems.
Rather than treatment. Or education.
Was definitely part of the story, but at the same time, it's not the only part of the story. If you look at the historical record, these things weren't initiated by black communities. I mean, the punitive response was and the whole drug war ideology was more coming from white politicians who were trying to score points and gain political following.
If you sort of scratch the surface deeper to look at what is causing the epidemic of drug use at this time and, you know, why certain communities are struggling, what happens if you add in the factor of poverty?
Well, so poverty matters. So first of all, to some extent, this is not a specific thing that I've really dug into a lot. It is true that what's called industrial restructuring was happening. And so businesses were moving out of urban areas, and communities that had been black working class communities where people had jobs in local businesses were often being devastated, and the next generation was having very high levels of unemployment and a lot of joblessness. So that was certainly part of what was going on. And certainly the choice of addiction, there's all kinds of stress factors that increase the choice of addiction. So it's not so much that being poor specifically makes you use drugs or drink alcohol, but more that the stresses associated with poverty may lead you to, you know, escapist mm-hmm. responses is what I think. And again, I'm not an expert in addiction, but that is what I understand to be kind of how it works. You also have kind of the market factors that if young people, or for that matter, older people, don't have better ways to earn living, then drug dealing looks like an attractive way to earn money. If, you know, it's kind of right. What are your alternatives? And so there was also the case that in the late 80s, there were kind of expanding markets and actually a lot of money to be made in dealing drugs. There definitely were some people, not most people just barely got by dealing drugs, but people could some people made enough money to buy their way out of drug dealing, actually. I mean, there were people who dealt drugs to then go to college and buy a house and support their mother and work their way out of the situation that they were in. That isn't normally what happened. I mean, most people who dealt drugs were making the equivalent of minimum wage dealing drugs. But I think it's the combination of stress contributing to the desire for addictive substances mm-hmm. and the marketing that made it very available because of the availability of young people to deal the drugs.
And lack of other opportunities
in terms of
jobs or school or something else. Wouldn't poverty also play a role in what kind of lawyer you could get so that even if you were, let's say you were caught and then you find yourself in the system, that if you are poor and given a public defender who has little time to work on your case, that your outcome is going to be very different than if you have a fancy team of lawyers?
Definitely. So, and I need to be careful because often the public defenders are actually better lawyers. I mean, so in many cases, your worst option is a court-appointed lawyer. The PDs often have more training and more insiderness in the system, but it's certainly true that
I guess I didn't really know the difference between a public defender and a court-appointed lawyer.
Uh-huh. So it happens in Wisconsin all the time. So public defenders, that's their job.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas court-appointed lawyers, you have the right to a lawyer, but the court just picks some lawyer to it's not their job to be a public defender. They're an attorney in private practice, and they get told to do this job by the government. So it's the sort of unwilling court-appointed lawyers that in some cases are the less enthusiastic and the less well-trained. I mean, I just want to mm-hmm. be careful because there's often a tendency to slam the public defenders, and I'm not
– right.
They are overworked. That's certainly true. And so they are trying to triage their cases and work through them as quickly as they can. But the system yeah. varies a lot from state to state.
But if you look at the system going all the way through, once you've gotten charged, then there's the factor of the lawyer you have. There's who
right.
is on that jury And also disparities in sentencing and stereotypes.
Well, the jury almost never is a factor, actually, because the vast majority of cases are pled out. So it's well over 90%. It's actually, I think, only 1-3% of all cases go to trial. And so it's really the plea bargaining process that matters. And the most important thing in the plea bargaining process is whether you're detained. So if you are detained before adjudication...
You mean because you can't make bail?
Because you can't make bail.
So there's another poverty issue.
So the bail is actually, I think, where a lot of... So first of all, I'm not disputing that if you have a good lawyer, good lawyers were getting people off, absolutely. You know, but the way it happens is through bargaining. But getting out pre-trial is really important. If you are incarcerated pre-trial, the only way you can get out is to plead guilty. You have to plead guilty to get out. Otherwise, you will sit in jail for months, even years, awaiting trial. And so there's tremendous pressure on somebody who's detained pre-trial to somehow cut a deal and get out. And I think that's where a lot of the action is. And I haven't done a detailed study of this, but my superficial reading of some literature, but I'm not saying I've done the detailed lit review. But as far as I can tell, there's more disparity in cases that are detained pretrial and pled out. That's actually where a lot of the action is.
Hmm. We are going to look at disparities right here in Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Mass incarceration is a racial justice issue. Wisconsin imprisons a greater percentage of its African-American male citizens than any other state in the country, and by a wide margin. That's from some words from Peter Marino, director of Odyssey Beyond Bars. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Pamela Oliver, and we are talking about mass incarceration and race. Let's talk about Wisconsin. You know, it's not something that you would really expect, I think, if you know, we're used to thinking about Mississippi and Alabama mm-hmm. as having such a bad record on racism and a troubled past. Why? Well, first of all, could you just talk about Wisconsin's record as one of the worst in the country, if not the worst, at locking up black men disproportionately?
Yeah, I haven't actually run the black men versus – I generally just run all people together, but – Wisconsin is definitely consistently at least in the top five. And the southern states actually have lower black incarceration rates than the northern states on average. The high black incarceration rates are in states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, New Jersey, Massachusetts. So it's ironically those northern liberal states where whites are pretty well off that have the highest black incarceration rates. And some of that is, I think, so I've been asking myself that question for the last 20 years, why? And I'm not sure I know the answer exactly to why. I have some tentative answers that I've tried to research, but so some of the things I know are correlated with it. It's the states where white people are relatively well off, ideologically pretty liberal. And black people are more recent migrants to the area and are on average poorer than the white people. So there's higher disparities. It's not the absolute level of black poverty, but the ratio of black to white poverty, basically, that seems to be more important. But also, it's not just that. I mean, that's important. But it's also, I think it's... competitive politics is part of it. What I mean by that is these are ideologically liberal states, but states where both Democrats and Republicans win office. So they're politically competitive.
And sort of swing states, too.
Yeah, they're swing states, politically competitive states. And one of the things that was definitely going on in the rise in incarceration was kind of an ideological arms war between the two parties to see who could be the toughest on crime. I mean, most people construe the Republicans as tougher on crime. They sort of staked out that territory. But a lot of the sort of racialized tough on crime rhetoric actually started with Southern Democrats. And pretty early in the game, the Democrats did not want to be out-toughed by the Republicans. And so really both parties were trying to out-tough each other. And there's a lot of ways in which they kept ratcheting up the penalties as each one was trying to outdo the other and who could be the toughest. And so one belief I have is that that dynamic, that competitive dynamic, is part of what played a role. The other thing that I think happens is that incarceration is actually really, really expensive. And so by now, you are seeing conservative politicians wanting to reduce incarceration rates because it's gotten so expensive. And because of the racial disparities, the states with high percentage black, there's kind of an upper limit on what proportion of black people they can lock up because they just can't afford it. Whereas in the white states, predominantly white states where black people are a small proportion of the population, I mean, to put it cynically, you can score political points locking up black people at pretty high rates and at very high rates. And because they're a small proportion of the total population, it's still not getting completely out of control in terms of the cost of the system. So that's actually my rather cynical explanation. Mm-hmm. I can't say, as an academic, I have to say, I don't feel like I've been able to prove that in the research. I haven't done the kind of research that would prove that. But that's my best guess about why you were seeing this dynamic is a small population that can be kind of demonized without a lot of cost to the larger population. I mean, another way to think about, we used to say this and now you can see it happening, is that if the drug war had not been racially targeted, it would have ended a lot sooner. It was because the harm of the drug war was so focused because of residential racial segregation, so focused on black communities that it was allowed to run as long as it did. And as drug abuse has been rising among whites, drug deaths have been rising among whites, and my data show drug incarcerations rising among whites, particularly in rural areas and poorer white areas. As that's happened, you can see the shift to a treatment discourse and a shift saying, oh, wait, all this incarceration is not really good. We should really be focusing on treatment once the problem is really white people instead of black people. So there's a lot of people noticing the ways in which the white heroin epidemic is really being discussed in very different ways from the way the crack cocaine epidemic was discussed at the end of the 80s and the early 90s.
And if you look at Wisconsin's record over the last few decades, how bad is the racial disparity? How much more likely are you to get locked up in Wisconsin if you are a black man?
So I can't actually answer that. I could have answered that specific question if I ran the numbers, but I don't actually know the answer to that specific question. I can tell you that when I started this project, which was almost 20 years ago now, the racial disparity was about 20 to 1.
So that you would have been 20 times more likely
to go to
prison time.
And it was actually more like 60 to 1 for drug charges, prison admissions.
That's pretty shocking.
It was huge. So it's still high. I think it's down to more in the range of 10 to 1. So the racial disparity in Wisconsin and actually the country as a whole has actually been declining. It's been declining since 2000 and especially since 2007. So that it's a lot lower now than it was, but it's still quite high. It's still a ratio of, as I say, I'm guessing probably about 10 to 1 now in Wisconsin. But there have been things happening that have brought that disparity back down. It really peaked nationally, the racial disparity peaked actually in the mid-90s. And it's been coming down since then. And in Wisconsin, it peaked in the early 2000s and has been coming down since then. You can see in the data that both Milwaukee County and Dane County have had steep decreases in black imprisonment rates for drugs. At the same time, as many parts of the state have had increases in white incarceration for drugs. And so that's like shifting the disparity ratio. As white goes up, black comes down, the disparity ratio has been shifting quite a bit.
Hmm. And if you look at other kinds of offenses, for example, drunk driving, can you talk about that and how that plays out in Wisconsin?
Well, I used that as an example because I was trying to talk about the politics. And so it's more fun if you can actually see the graph. But prior to the mid-1990s, there were essentially no incarcerations for drunk driving. And then white incarceration for drunk driving starts increasing in the 90s and keeps going up until the late 2000s. So I asked the audience, you know, what happened? Did white people suddenly start driving drunk in the mid-90s? And the answer is no, the law changed. I use it as an example of how it's really the enforcement decisions, the law and the penalties and the enforcement decisions that really affect incarceration. So I don't think the rate of driving drunk in Wisconsin went up. If anything, it went down. There came to be a anti-drunk driving campaign.
Mothers against drunk driving
and the social movement against drunk driving.
So the advocacy to have stiffer penalties is part of it?
Wisconsin was actually pretty late in the game in increasing its penalties. It held out. And it was only when the federal government said you would lose transportation funds if you didn't, increase the penalties for drunk driving that Wisconsin finally capitulated. But I was amused because when I moved here, this is the only state I've ever been in which state legislators defended the right to drive drunk.
And sometimes drove drunk themselves.
Yes. Driving drunk yourself is actually pretty common around the country, but it's one of those things that in many parts of the country you don't defend the right to drive drunk. You don't say it's a good thing to be able to drive drunk. So that would be an example. So drunk driving became an important source of incarceration for white people in Wisconsin, partly because they weren't incarcerated for a lot of other things, but there was a steep rise in drunk driving incarcerations from the mid-90s into the late mid-2010s, it started to level off.
Sometimes you also read about the impact of the three strikes and you're out kind of rule. Can you talk about that and what kind of
I can, although I don't have data that lets me directly address that, but it was really important, especially in California, but also Wisconsin has one of those laws. That would be repeat offenders. So they would show up in my data as people going back into prison for a new crime. And the essential idea of a three strikes law is even if the new crime is a pretty minor crime, if you're a repeat offender, you're going to get a very long sentence for a minor crime. And so in some states, a lot of people were locked up for a really long time basically on these three strikes rules. It was particularly an important part of what was going on in California. I haven't actually done the kind of analysis that would allow me to say how big of a factor it was in Wisconsin.
Okay. And what are the statistics showing about violent crime? And we've been talking mostly about drug offenses, alcohol, et cetera. But if you look at rates of things like murder and assault, how does that look?
That's a great question. And if I'd done my homework, I could give you a more specific answer about it. So I do know what happened in the 90s. After the mid-1990s, there was a big rise in especially white incarceration for violent crimes. And again, it was an increase in the penalties. In Wisconsin, I believe that the recent trends are that I'm not saying recent last 3 years because I don't have those data, but recent as in through the mid-2010s, which is what I do have data for. There was a rise in white incarceration for violent crime as well. And murder, so people, there's a pretty steady rate of people going to prison for murder that was up slightly, I believe. But murder is a very small percentage of prison admissions in any given year. It's a larger percentage of people who are actually in prison because once you're in prison for murder, you don't leave. And so you sort of stack up in prison. rape was actually rising as a source of incarceration. Not so much new. So what's been happening with sexual offenders, people are sentenced to prison for rape, but then they're also returned to prison at pretty high rates. So they get out and then they come back in. And a lot of people think that a lot of that is the conditions of supervision for rapists and sex offenders are very stringent, and it's pretty easy to violate the terms of supervision for sex offenders. And so when I was looking at the Wisconsin data, I was seeing that both that people were being sentenced to prison for sexual assault, but also that a lot of people were being returned to prison for violations of supervision as sex offenders.
And if you look at the state right now, for example, is it true that there's more people on parole than in prison, or that there's a big proportion of people who are sort of in the system?
Yeah.
So my just sort of anecdotal impression from the students I work with is that it is easy to commit a parole violation.
It is.
That just about any false step, and that there's some racism involved in that as well in terms of who is considered to be violating parole and sent back.
So let's unpack it. First, although I personally didn't generate the numbers, I'm pretty sure it is true that there are a lot more people on supervision. And in Wisconsin, at this point, there are relatively few people in the official category parole and a lot of people in the official category extended supervision, which has to do with the nature of the law. It is true that it's quite easy to be revoked on a let's call it a parole violation. And there's a ton of pretty, at times, hot and contested debate about what's going on with this. One thing that I think everybody who understands how the system works has to agree, there's a lot of discretion at the PO, the probation and parole officer, has a very high level of discretion. And they vary. The offices vary. The offices are kind of controlled by the supervisors. Supervisors vary. And within supervisors, individuals vary. And everybody in the system will tell stories about how one PO thought something was perfectly fine and another PO revoked them for it. So that there's individual variation, absolutely true. Another thing that is true is that the POs are, I think, disproportionately white women. And the people being supervised, at least in the southern part of the state, are disproportionately black men. And so there are definitely race-gender dynamics that play out. Exactly how they – I hear people talk, right? So I hear mm-hmm. people gripe about racism all the time, and I'm not saying that they're wrong, but I'm also trying to be careful as I talk about things. One of the things that I've thought about in – not so much about POs, but about police officers and correctional guards. So those are the cases that I – you would hear a lot of stories where you could hear the gender-race dynamics play out. So that what would often happen – with a white woman police officer, a correctional officer, and a black accused offender, a black prison inmate, is the black guy would say something sexist, and then the white officer would respond, and then things would get into this complicated race-gender kind of spinning out of control situation. Mm-hmm. So I bring that thinking to bear when I think about what might be going on with POs, but I don't actually know. It's entirely speculative.
It's interesting to me, too, that state to state, there's quite a few differences in how people on parole are treated, where some are able to vote and some are not.
That's right.
Just kind of state by state, there's not the same approach.
There's tons of state variation and often local variation. So I understand from Cecilia Klingel, who I've just been listening. I've gone to a couple of her talks recently, and she's been studying Wisconsin specifically. And she's also actually studied some northern areas that are all white. Wisconsin's unusual in that the system is actually statewide. In most places, there's a lot of local control of the system. But she does report definitely differences between offices and their standards. No, wait, I lost the thread. We were talking about...
talking about a disparity between state as to...
Oh, yeah. So the states vary a ton in a lot of things. One is they vary a ton in how much time you get on supervision. So many people think that after you leave prison, you probably need some help reintegrating. And 6 months, maybe a year or two max, where you, your PO helps you get housing, helps you get a job, family issues, gets you into treatment, is probably on balance positive. But I think most of the research says that when you have really long periods of supervision, it doesn't help you reintegrate. It just increases your chance of being thrown back in on a violation. And so the states vary a lot in how long people are on supervision. They vary a lot in their revocation rates. They vary a lot in how they run their systems. So you can see tremendous state variations basically in the statistics. And those statistics are coming from these huge variations in just how they're running their systems.
More on mass incarceration and race when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I came into prison at the age of 16, barely knowing how to read and write. Since then, I've learned that's all I do, read and write. I always wonder how life would have been different if I would have discovered my potential sooner. The words of an African-American prisoner at Oak Hill Prison in Wisconsin. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I'm back with Pamela Oliver. We are talking about mass incarceration and race. We've been mostly talking about black versus white disparities and some of the reasons behind that. What about other populations such as the Native Americans or Latinos?
So it's a great question that I wish I had better answers for you for. The black-white disparities are a lot higher than the native-white or the Hispanic-white disparities, and so I tended to focus on them. But there's absolutely issues about Native people and Hispanics. One problem with both of those populations is for different reasons, they're more likely to end up in the federal system, which I've never had data about. And so the numbers are often not comparable. But there are definitely so Hispanic people who are not citizens often end up getting deported, and that affects the statistics. Native people, crimes, depending on the crime and whether they're on the reservation, sometimes goes to federal court rather than state, or minor crimes may go to the tribal courts. So there's both definitely issues, and I keep thinking the study that needs to be done that I haven't done but we should do is actually report on Native incarceration rates, because they are definitely very high in some places. And Wisconsin is actually quite high in Native incarceration rates, and similarly Hispanics. But as I said, it's a combination. They're definitely a problem, higher than white, not as high as black typically. And in each case, there are some specific reasons that you have to worry about how the numbers are going to be comparable.
I know that with your work, you're looking a lot at numbers and
graphs
and statistics and so on. Is there a way that you can take that and also look at the real life consequences for a person and his family, for example, that what you're talking about, where sometimes the disparity rate might be somewhere between 10 and 20 times higher a likelihood that if you're African-American, you're going to prison? And just sort of translate them to what does that mean for a family, for a community?
So one of the obvious things it means is that African-American children are much more likely to experience having a parent go to prison. It's extremely disruptive for children, particularly if that parent has been involved in their life. In some cases, they haven't been. But often, if it's their mother, they've typically been involved in their life. And often the fathers have been involved. And so children often experience both emotional trauma of losing a parent and the disruption of their lives. The children may end up in foster care, or they end up in economically deprived circumstances. So it's extremely devastating to families in many ways. And there's a – because people don't talk through crime, they tend to think of every criminal as if they were a serial killer or something. They forget that a lot of people who broke the law may have actually been providing for their family. In some cases, they're committing property crimes to provide for their families. Or even if they had an aspect where they were doing bad things, they were also doing good things. And so the loss of this person and the family can be devastating. It also costs a lot of money to have a relative in prison. There's all these costs to the families because there's exorbitant telephone rates and exorbitant mm-hmm. commissary rates. And if the family's trying to stay in touch with their incarcerated loved one, it's very expensive for the families. So it's very disruptive. It also disrupts communities because you pull working-age adults out of the community. So you reduce the number of adults in the community available to do things like run the church boards and run the community meetings, fill the occupational niches. So it's actually has massive effects. It's very bad for the individual because it disrupts their life. If they were it prevents them from getting on a standard life course of building skills, building education, and building a career. And so it's bad for them and also bad for a lot of the people around them.
One quote that I've seen that I like is from Victor Hugo, who said, "He who opens a school door closes a prison." Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between lack of education and incarceration?
It's a really complicated story. So it's definitely the case that the incarceration rates are highest among people who dropped out of high school. To some extent, it's kind of a feedback loop because the young people who are getting into trouble and not going to school, I mean, not going to school and getting into trouble are kind of, in many cases, two sides of the same coin. So getting involved in juvenile delinquency may be why you don't have as much education. But it's definitely an issue. There's also discussions of the dynamics of schools, where in some cases the schools seem to push kids out of the school and kind of not let them go to school, and that feeds into juvenile delinquency, which feeds into adult delinquency, which feeds into prison. So,
like getting labeled early on.
Getting labeled early on and stuff. So, I mean, education I think is good. It would be an entirely different interview to point out that you can't educate yourself out of inequality. Like if you're running an unequal society where there's kind of this distribution of jobs, then some of them don't pay very well. You can have college-educated people making minimum wage. If you can get everybody educated, that's not going to – I mean, there's some ways in which you can shift the economy by educating everybody, but you can't solve inequality just by educating people. You need to run a more equal system.
You talked about how it's costly to have someone incarcerated, but it's also big business. The prison industry is making a lot of money off of people being in prison.
That's right. And
if you're going to be cynical, as you were a little while ago.
No, lots of people have a financial stake in prisons, and it's important. I often get asked the private prison question, and private prisons are actually a pretty small piece of the game. But private business is a big piece of the game. And it happens – so partly some communities want the prison there because it provides jobs. So even their public jobs, correctional officer jobs. There are the businesses that provide food to the prisons. There are the ankle bracelet companies. Like the private prison companies are actually getting in the ankle bracelet business. So community supervision is now booming. People are making money on community supervision. They're making money on the commissaries. So there's a lot of people who actually have a stake in prisons because they're making money running the prisons or supplying the prisons or building the prisons.
So given that there is this problem with mass incarceration and race remaining in Wisconsin and in the country as a whole, do you have any thoughts from having looked at data and worked on this area a long time about solutions, about what we should be thinking about going forward?
I've actually looked at this quite a bit. So the first thing to say is there's no magic bullet. It's not going to fit on a placard. You can put on a placard prison abolitionism, let's have no prisons. You can put that and you can have that as a goal. But how you're going to get there is there's a lot of things to dismantle. So in fact, black drug sentences went way down in this country. And I do think that the political activism around the drug war is unfair and racially targeted had an impact. I feel quite confident that that was part of why those drug sentences went down. And you can see other ways in which the actions of reformers, either the kind of social movement groups or the reformers within the system, to try to change things, you can see those effects. So I don't think nothing changes. I think if you push on a system, you pay attention to how to change the system, it does change. The trouble is you have to change lots of things. So the drug war is one of them. There's people talking about, at the lower end of the distribution, restorative justice courts. Really the abolitionists, that's what they're saying, is focus on healing and restoring the victim instead of just punishing the perpetrator. You want to look at reducing time on supervision. So one thing you want to do is reduce revocation rates, and you do that, some of that, by just reducing how long people are on supervision. It's not the only solution, but it's part of it. You need to talk back to the phrase violent crime. Because there's a huge distribution of things that people actually did that are all lumped together as violent crime. And be willing to reconsider the penalties for this very diverse set of stuff. You need to revisit parole. Let people out. You know, most people, the vast majority of people, after they've served 10 years, should probably be let out. And there's a whole discussion about that. There's also just sending fewer people to prison in the first place, like just give fewer sentences. There's one line of research that argues that part of what fed the prison boom was upcharging. So for any given thing that you did, you were more likely to be charged with a felony rather than a misdemeanor. And so pushing back on the charging, like revisiting the whole package. There's a lot of discussion of how elected prosecutors are a big part of the problem. And I'm not saying it's the system of electing prosecutors.
Because they want to show they're tough on crime.
Because they're subject to political pressure. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is that the general public is often punitive, even kind of crazy punitive, punitive in ways that don't actually reduce crime, that increase crime. I mean, there are criminogenic effects of a lot of punitive policies. There's a lot of evidence that for a lower level offender, or for, say, a juvenile who's just done nothing or something minor, over punishing somebody actually makes the problem worse.
Because it makes them come out angry or have a hardened criminal? Out.
So there's multiple things for this. So let's say in the supervision business, the reason over-supervising somebody is criminogenic is if you have to do too much for supervision, it's really hard to hold a job. It's really hard to reintegrate with your family. It's really hard to just kind of reduce that psychological tension and kind of turn back into an ordinary person who doesn't really think about committing crimes. So, you know, too much supervision can actually disrupt the reintegration. And with children, I think the issue is sort of similar in that, you know, if you treat a kid as bad, it makes them bad in a way.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And to some extent, that happens with adults, right? I mean, mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of stuff about the interactional dynamics. If you treat somebody as watching for them to do something wrong, it creates kind of the stress situation that makes it more likely they will do something wrong. So the people in the business, and I'm really not in the business of supervision, but I was at a conference where there were people talking about this. They were saying that it's really important to believe your risk assessment. You need to provide for people who are high risk, what they need is lots of services and treatment. And for people who are low risk, what you really need is let them alone and leave them alone so that they can go about the business of reintegrating.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about on the topic of mass incarceration and race. My guest has been Pamela Oliver. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.